Well, perhaps the best known contemporary example of a man who inspired a fearful and despairing nation into courageous resolve and action was Winston Churchill when he spoke before Commons on June 4th, 1940. Under threat of invasion by Germany, Churchill's famous speech entitled, "We Shall Never Surrender," inspired England to stand fast against Adolf Hitler and the entire Nazi regime. In that speech, Churchill said, and I quote him, "The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and their need, will defend to the death their native soils, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength, even though a large tract of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule. We shall not flag nor fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France and on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on beaches, landing grounds, in fields, in streets, and on the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for the moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire across or beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, will carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, sets forth to the liberation and rescue of the old." End quote. With that speech, Churchill inspired England to courageous resolve and action to protect and to defend their island nation. However, another great leader named Nehemiah inspired the ancient Israelites to courageously act by building walls of protection around their war-torn capital city of Jerusalem. And therefore, the theme of today's text passage read in your hearing is this: Nehemiah inspires Israel to action. And there are three points related to that theme. They're printed on the right-hand side of your bulletin there, so you could follow along as I read them. First, in verses 11 to 15, we have Nehemiah's thorough and realistic examination of the city's condition. Second, in verses 16 to 18, Nehemiah's inspiring exhortation to rebuild. And third, in verses 19 and 20, the enemy's efforts to impede Nehemiah's plan to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and gates. Before we consider those points, let's first look at the context and setting of the passage. It comes to us in verses 9 and 10, which says, again, look at it, "Then I went to the governors in the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters." Now, the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. In verse 9, Nehemiah refers to regional governors whom he encountered on his westward trip. That was an 850-mile journey, you know, beyond the Euphrates River from Shushan, which was in modern-day Iraq, all the way to Jerusalem. Today, by the way, you could drive that distance in about 32 hours at an average speed of about 30 miles an hour, which is as fast as you could go, because many of the roads between those places are dirt or gravel. However, in Nehemiah's day, the 850-mile trip took about 2 months. 2 months. Verse 9 also tells us that Nehemiah was authorized and empowered to travel freely through the regions beyond the river because he was in possession of something. He was in possession of the king's letters. You recall that at Nehemiah's request, King Artaxerxes had given him letters addressed to the governors of various regions, which permitted Nehemiah to safely pass through them until he arrived in Judah. Also notice at the end of verse 9, something else that King Artaxerxes gave to Nehemiah to ensure his safe arrival in Jerusalem. It says, now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So Nehemiah had a military escort. Wow. Probably an impressive one too. To accompany him and to protect him on his long journey from Shushan to Jerusalem. Imagine how much stronger it was for Nehemiah to present the king's letter to a regional governor with a contingent of the king's army and officers at his side than it would have been to simply hand the governor a letter. It meant what one author called an arrival in style, impressively reinforcing Nehemiah's presentation of his credentials to the neighboring governors and making very plain the change of King Artaxerxes' royal policy concerning the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. It wasn't too many years prior to this that the same king who commissioned Nehemiah to go to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls forbade anyone to do that. So this took some explanation on the king's part. But even armed with the king's letter and a military escort, there were some officials who were deeply disturbed with the arrival of a man who had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel, namely Nehemiah. Two of those people are mentioned here in verse 10 by the names of Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. And a third named Geshem the Arab is later introduced in verse 19. We'll get to that. Many believe that Sanballat was the governor of Samaria, and Tobiah is identified as an Ammonite who was a notorious, bitter enemy of Israel. And both of them, along with Geshem, continued to be disruptive and cause problems and trouble throughout the project to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and gates, and we'll see that in chapters 4 through 7. So what Nehemiah experienced from the beginning, and what the application for us is this. Listen, when you seek to do the will and work of God, you will inevitably collide with those who oppress or oppose you, with the Sanballats, the Tobiahs, and the Geshems of the world. And they are everywhere, in your neighborhood, at work, sometimes even in your own family and household. In fact, frequently when you do or seek to do God's will, there will be some who will rise up and oppose what you're doing. They'll oppose the work. In other words, one of the consequences of living in this fallen world is that there will often be opposition to any work of God. But as we work our way through this book, we're going to learn from Nehemiah how to deal with it. How to deal with and respond to opponents who don't want the spiritual well-being and prosperity of God's people and are deeply disturbed with you if you seek it. Nehemiah was a great leader. He was an exceptionally great leader. And therefore, the way he dealt with and responded to his opponents is highly useful and instructive for us. So that's the historical context of today's passage. We come now to the first main point taken from verses 11 to 15, which is this on your outline. Notice Nehemiah's thorough and realistic examination of the city's condition. Verse 11. Look at it. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. 850-mile journey now, right? 2 months on the road. He got there to Jerusalem and he was there for 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent well and the refuse gate and viewed or examined the walls of Jerusalem which were broken down and its gates which were burned with fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal under me to pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. And then I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. Well, it had been a long, strenuous journey from Shushan to Jerusalem. So Nehemiah was understandably in need of a little rest, right? So verse 11 implies that he spent the first 3 days after his arrival in Jerusalem resting. And leaders, listen, leaders of all kinds, including church leaders, should take time to rest in order to be able to continue serving the Lord and his people. Jesus did, right? And his apostles did. In fact, mark it down in Mark chapter 6, verse 31. It records that Jesus told his weary apostles, "Come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while." Well, next in verse 12 and following in chapter 2, we see the secret nighttime examination that Nehemiah and a few of his best men embarked upon. I say secret because Nehemiah had not disclosed to anyone what God had prompted him to do and to accomplish at Jerusalem. You notice what he said in verse 12. He said, "I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem." So under the cover of night, verse 13 describes the nighttime examination or inspection that Nehemiah conducted, viewing the real, unvarnished condition of Jerusalem's gates and her walls. Verses 13 to 15 lists many of these, and little is known about the particulars of any of them. But the main point is this, that concerning all of them, the walls of Jerusalem were broken down and all of her gates were burned with fire. So in car repair lingo, The walls and gates of the city were totaled. They were totaled. Nothing was standing. Everything was burning. In fact, in verse 14, there wasn't even room enough for Nehemiah's horse to pass through certain gates. Apparently, the trash and refuse was piled too high. But Nehemiah didn't withhold or falsify the city's true condition. Instead, his examination of it was thorough and realistic. Now, here's an application for church leaders. Again, it's this. In their assessment of things, church leaders must honestly assess a church's spiritual condition and accept bad news as well as good. In other words, church leaders must not live in a dream world. On the contrary, they must live in the realm of reality. They need to have, as it were, 20/20 vision when it comes to interpreting the real spiritual condition of the church, of worship, and of the people of God. It's interesting, isn't it, that Nehemiah saw more at night than the Israelites saw in the day. And he interpreted the real condition of things better at nighttime than others did during the daytime. So let's strive to see things as they really are, like Nehemiah did, who was thorough and realistic in his examination of Jerusalem's true condition. Now, against the backdrop of Nehemiah's painfully honest and realistic assessment of the city's condition, the second point taken from verses 16 to 18 is this on your outline. Notice Nehemiah's inspiring exhortation to rebuild Jerusalem. Look at verse 16. It says, "And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste or desolate, and its gates are burned with fire. Come, and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach, or that we may no longer suffer derision and shame.' And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, 'Let us rise up and build.' And then they set their hands to this good work." Now, according to verse 16, up to this point in time, Nehemiah had been operating in what we might call, or what's often called, stealth mode, privately gathering information about the city walls and gates behind the scenes. However, the time had now come, and Nehemiah sensed it. He had sufficient time to gather the facts and the information that he needed, and the time had now come for Nehemiah to discuss his findings to the Jews and to all their priests, nobles, and officials. Timing was everything. And isn't that true when you've got something really important to share, that timing is of the essence? Timing is everything, isn't it? And he knew that timing was everything, and the time had now come to exhort the Jews to rise up and build and set their hands to this good work, which for 100 years hadn't happened under previous leaders. 100-year wait to build these walls. That is a long, long time. So he gathered everyone together in one place. We don't know where, but the general population of the Jewish people were there, the religious priests, the noblemen, the governing officials, and others who did the common labor. And then, in verse 17, notice, Nehemiah gave them his painfully honest assessment of their condition and of the condition of their city with these words. Then I said to them, "You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste or desolate, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach, or that we may no longer suffer derision and shame." Like Churchill, who gave an exhortation that inspired England to courageous resolve and action, so too did Nehemiah inspire Israel to courageously act by rebuilding her walls and gates, and by building walls of protection around their war-torn capital city, Jerusalem. And in an effort to further motivate and encourage the Jews, in verse 18, notice Nehemiah gave the Jews two additional motives for rebuilding Jerusalem. First, he said, "I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me," which means that God's gracious favor, or his good and gracious hand, had been upon Nehemiah in prompting him to initiate and to lead up this rebuilding effort. And the second motivation in verse 18 is this, "And also of the king's words that he had spoken to me," which means that Nehemiah knew, he knew with absolute certainty, the words that King Artaxerxes had spoken to him. In fact, he had the king's letters, which empowered and authorized Nehemiah and gave him the king's authority. So when the Jews considered those things, they were encouraged, motivated, they were inspired to rebuild Jerusalem. And together they said, "Let us rise up and build." And then they set their hands to this good work. It had been 100-year delay, and now the rebuilding starts. And do you know how long it took to build those walls around Jerusalem? Come back and you'll find out. No, 52 days the job was done. In 52 days. But here's a couple applications from the second point. The first one is this: the distressful condition of the church is a powerful motive for appealing to believers to work at recovering her. Again, the distressful condition of the church. And there's a parallel here, isn't there? The distressful condition of Israel, and that translates to the distressful condition of the church. Have you ever sensed that the condition of the church in our day is distressful? Well, perhaps you've made that perception or evaluation. It certainly has the ring of truth in it. The distressful condition of the church is a powerful motive for appealing to believers to work at recovering her. In verse 17, Nehemiah stated it plainly. "You see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and desolate, and its gates are burned with fire." It's right on the heels of words like those that Nehemiah gives his inspiring exhortation to rebuild Jerusalem at the end of verse 17, where he said, "Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem." In other words, Nehemiah motivated his kinsmen to rebuild and recover the city because of its distressful, desolate condition, and also because its condition had been, did you notice, a source of reproach or derision and shame to them. So Nehemiah says, let's not continue being a reproach to others around us. Let's not be derided and shamed any longer. Instead, let's rebuild what's broken down and in need of repair and recovery. And may "come and let us build" be the church's slogan and motivation today. Another application is this: identify with people whom you lead in their task. Again, identify with people whom you lead in their task. Did you notice how Nehemiah identified himself with the people's problem? Notice three words in verse 17, and maybe circle them: we, us, and we again. Look at them. "Then I said to them," verse 17, "you see the distress that we are in. How Jerusalem lies waste, its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach." In order for Nehemiah to motivate the Jews to build the walls of Jerusalem, he had to identify himself with their need. And that's what a good leader does to motivate others. Can you imagine how the Jews would have responded if Nehemiah had instead said something like, "You've gotten yourselves into a really bad mess. So what you've got to do is rebuild those walls. If you need me, then I'll be in my office. Give me a call." That wouldn't have gone over very well, would it? And he didn't respond that way. Instead, he did what all good leaders do, by identifying with people in their task and by using pronouns like "us" and "we." All right, the third and last point taken from verses 19 and 20 on your outline: the enemy's intimidating efforts to impede Nehemiah's plan to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and gates. Verse 19, notice, "But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, 'What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?' So I answered them and said to them, 'The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore we are his servants. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem.'" Well, it seems that the closer Nehemiah gets to rebuilding Jerusalem, the more opposition continues to arise. Earlier in verse 10, you recall that when Nehemiah first arrived in Jerusalem, there were two opponents, right? Sanballat and Tobiah. They were both deeply disturbed that someone, namely Nehemiah, had come to seek the well-being and the recovery, as it were, of this city and the children of Israel. But now, on the eve of the Jews rising up to begin rebuilding Jerusalem's gates and walls, a third formidable opponent joins the opposition, named Geshem the Arab. And all three of these enemies of Israel intimidated them and made extremely serious charges against them. in verse 19. First, they laughed and jeered at them and also despised them. They alleged that Nehemiah and the Jews were rebelling against the king, especially since they knew that some years earlier, the same king, Artaxerxes, had forbade the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And all of these things were threats and intimidation. They were the enemy's intimidating efforts to impede Nehemiah's plan to rebuild Jerusalem's walls and gates. And verse 20 shows us how Nehemiah responded to these attempts at intimidation. He answered them, notice, by saying, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build." Now notice this. Nehemiah knew that King Artaxerxes was 100% supportive of rebuilding Jerusalem, but he nonetheless attributed his authority to rebuild it to the God of heaven, who himself will prosper us. Nehemiah's confident faith in God was sure that God himself would prosper the Jews in their rebuilding task, and Nehemiah was equally confident that God's enemies who opposed the work of rebuilding would have no portion or heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Well, here's the applications as we conclude. The first one is this: expect efforts to restore the spiritual condition of the church to be vigorously opposed. Again, expect efforts to restore the spiritual condition of the church to be vigorously opposed. Remember that from the moment Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, the opposition began, right? Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, they all showed up. And their weapons were usually verbal, intimidation and ridicule. "What is this thing that you're doing?" And also the weaponry of threats and accusations. "Will you rebel against the king?" This rebuilding is an act of rebellion, was the charge that they made. These are some of the ways that Nehemiah was opposed. And similar weapons are still being used today. So expect efforts to restore the spiritual condition of the church to be vigorously opposed. The second application is this: great works for God can begin with only one person. Again, great works for God can begin with only one person. For instance, the second great awakening in America began when a 48-year-old businessman named Jeremiah Lamphere, who determined to besiege the throne of grace for the success of the gospel in New York City. This was a man who, all by his lonely self, decided that he would begin a prayer meeting in the center of New York City, in Manhattan. And he began to pray for the success of the gospel in that city. Eventually, Joseph Lamphere was joined by thousands of New Yorkers who met in various places all around the city, who prayed regularly for the spiritual recovery of the church, for the spiritual reviving of the church. It is estimated that in the calendar year 1857, there were approximately 1 million people who were converted to Christianity and who came to faith in Jesus Christ. Or consider William Carey. He's sometimes called the father of modern day missions. He was one man among millions in the nation of India. at a time when there were no other Christians. He labored for many years before seeing one convert enter the kingdom, which years later multiplied to be millions of Indian citizens who were the later fruits of Carey's efforts. But the point in both instances of Carey or Lamphere was that great works for God can begin with only one person. Great works for God can begin with only one person. In conclusion, let's remember that the theme of today's text is Nehemiah inspired Israel to action. When the Israelites heard Nehemiah's words to restore and rebuild Jerusalem's walls, and when the people understood that these words came with the king's authority, they acted immediately upon those words. And we'll see that next week in chapter 3. And similarly, listen, when we speak with the words of our king, Jesus, then how much more should people be inspired to action to restore and to rebuild? There's a man named Charles Simeon, a great preacher in the 19th century. And commenting on this, he said the following: "The world is in ruins. It's one great and shapeless mass of desolation, bearing upon the whole face of it the relentless efforts of the destroyer. And should not we, when informed of its miserable condition, be filled with grief, as Nehemiah was for Jerusalem, and implore mercy for it, as he did for that wasted city? Should we not improve our influence for its good and be ready by our own actions to promote to the uttermost its welfare?" Well, Christian, you are called by God to be like Nehemiah. You are called by God to be like Nehemiah, rebuilding and restoring what has been broken down and in need of repair. And your authority to do it is the same as Nehemiah's was: the words and the letters of your king. "Go into all the world, make disciples of all nations. Preach the gospel to every creature." Let me close by quoting one verse, Isaiah 58, verse 11, because it depicts the believer as a source of strength to the weak and as a builder and restorer of what sin has destroyed. "The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your soul in drought and strengthen your bones. You shall be like a watered garden and like a spring of water whose waters do not fail. Those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach and the restorer of streets to dwell in."